Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio in Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I'm joined by a man deep within the heart of the food community, Daniel Meyer, someone who helps folks like the amazing Mark Bittman, knows a thing or two about food policy, works with farms like Flying Pigs Farms, and has written more recipes than probably anyone in the universe. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Was that a proper introduction? Do you feel like I covered most of the bases?
I think that's great. You know, I don't, when people ask me what I do, I basically say that. I don't have a title for myself. I say I work for this person. I do work with that farm. I write this. I research that. So that's perfect.
So yeah, let's rewind the tape and tell me how you got into the food community.
So I couldn't have cared less about food or cooking for most of my, the majority of my life, probably until I was about 18. You know, when I was little, I only ate orange things, ramen, tortilla chips, macaroni and cheese, that sort of thing. The first time I ever cooked for real, I think, was when I was a freshman in college, came home for break, decided that's sort of the adult thing to do, and at that point I was very much into being grown up, not so much anymore, was to cook a big New Year's dinner party for all of my friends from college and from high school. So went to the store, loaded up on dried ziti and jarred tomato sauce, and, you know, overcooked the pasta like crazy, messed everything up, but had a blast. So that was when I started to cook. And from there, it just kind of snowballed and I got more into it and I started reading everything. And by the time I was a senior in college studying studio art, I was doing a photography thesis, which ended up being all self-portraits of me and food in some way. So at that point, it was sort of done. I knew that I was into it enough to have to give it a try after I left school. So I came to Brooklyn and started doing food job odds and ends and working for free and cooking for little money and scraping some stuff together, and it's worked out. Fingers crossed, it's still working out.
So yeah, I mean, you've written so many recipes, and, you know, first off, in the cooking theme, let's talk about, what are your favorite cookbooks?
It's funny, when I look at my cookbook shelf, I realize that most of the cookbooks I have are all sort of really old, and those are kind of the ones I love. I have a copy of the New York Times cookbook, which is a great book on its own, but it was given to me by my soon-to-be mother-in-law. I think it belonged to her grandmother or her great-grandmother or some great-aunt or something, and it's, you know, it's part cookbook and part sort of living personal history and diary. You know, every page is flagged with notes and check marks, and there's little inserts on index cards. I love that book, love that specific version of the book. What else? There's a book by Jacques Pepin called La Technique, which I may not have ever cooked out of, but I love to look at it. It's sort of like, it's a lot of vertical, it almost looks like film strips. It's little process shots of, you know, various techniques, cleaning sweetbreads, making pate, you know, all these things. Love to look at it. I can sort of hear his voice from TV and the radio when I look at it. That's one of my favorites. There's this book that my sister got me for my birthday a few years ago called the I Hate to Cook book by a woman named Peg Bracken. think it was written in the early 60s, maybe even 1960. And I think at the time it was sort of a way to liberate women who felt like they were sort of slaves to the household and the kitchen, and to try to free them from the constraints of spending all day slaving over the stove. But it's just great and it's hilarious. You know, it has things like, there's a recipe that'll just be a list of ingredients and say, mix all this stuff together. Or it'll say, you know, add onions, add a bit of cayenne. I really don't care. It doesn't matter. It's very flip. And I think at the time it was a very important book. And now it's sort of, I don't know, strangely it mirrors the way that I like to cook a lot of the time. So I love that one too. There's more, but, you know, how much time do we have?
What are you reading right now that's recently come out? Like, what new cookbooks are you psyched about?
I'm still on the Momofuku cookbook. That's not a recent one, but I've sort of been plotting my way through it and cooking through it slowly. I love that one. You know, it's funny. For somebody who writes recipes a ton, I don't have a tremendous amount of cookbooks. I like owning them as objects and physically leafing through them, and I love sort of the presence of them in my house, and I love reading them in my kitchen. But I'm not a voracious cookbook buyer, strangely enough.
I think it makes perfect sense. Not to mention you probably couldn't enjoy reading a cookbook because you read the technical side of it, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the new stuff at least. Like, old stuff, it's fun because I have the same problems where I like to collect old cookbooks and it's great to look at, but then you start to be like, oh, there's a typo or this typeset is off. Or
yeah, that happens a bit. I mean, I can still enjoy them. I guess, strangely enough, I feel like I have a greater sense of discovery for me in things that were written before my time than things that are sort of coming out currently. You know, when a book comes out now and is sort of the product of, I don't know, a trend that's been going on in the last few years or something that's happening in, you know, New York or some other big city that I've heard about, it feels, you know, it's certainly new in the sense that it's recent, but it doesn't feel like a total, a totally new thing to me. Whereas if I, you know, open up a Jacques Pepin cookbook and see all these crazy things that, French trained chefs were teaching and cooking in the 60s and 70s, that's an entirely new world to me. And that just like totally, totally fascinates me. I mean, not like I want to cook all that stuff all the time, but for entertainment value, love the oldies.
So, all right, a lot of people don't know what it really takes to write a recipe. You know, you read one, you're like, cool, that sounds really straightforward. But, you know, each cookbook has its own voice, own style, own kind of guide to the tools and the type. You know, maybe it's black pepper, maybe it's a crushed black pepper, whatever. Where do you get inspiration for writing a recipe? And then how do you actually write one? Take me through the process.
Sure. Well, you know, the inspiration can come from, I mean, they say inspiration can come from anywhere. I guess it's true with food too. I mean, you know, one of the easiest ways and the greatest way is you go someplace new or you eat something that you've never had before and you just get sort of this wave of inspiration and you say, oh God, I've never even thought of this, and that opens up a whole new set of possibilities. But, you know, the reality of, at least for me, of sitting down and writing recipes is that I'm, you know, cooped up in my apartment and you have to, you know, sit in there and think of, I don't know, 50, 100, however many recipe ideas. So it's not like you can cruise off to, you know, Thailand or Singapore every time you want to, you know, come up with a new idea. So for inspiration, sometimes I just open up the refrigerator and stare into it and look at ingredients. I'm always shocked at how many ideas I get just by looking at food. So I'll do that. I'll look in the fridge and the pantry. Sometimes I will just walk up and down the aisles of supermarkets. Works well for the farmer's market too if you're trying to write seasonally appropriate recipes. You know, a lot of recipes are already in your head. You just need something to trigger them and jog your memory a little bit. At least that's the way it works for me. Or else I'll flip through a cookbook, not necessarily to find a recipe and say, I want to make a better version of that recipe, but just to sort of get food and ingredients tumbling around in your head. You know, if I'm reading that Jacques Pepin book on all these old techniques, and there's a recipe in there, say, for, I don't know, there's a lot of things in jelly, like ham in aspic or something like that. I have no intention of making ham in aspic. I don't want to write a recipe for it. I don't particularly want to cook it. But it starts you thinking. You see ham in, you know, jelly, you start thinking, and I start thinking of Jell-O, and then I'm thinking of Jell-O, and you're thinking of, I don't know, tropical fruit, and now you're thinking about pork and fruit, and you're thinking about pork and pineapple, or, you know, whatever it is, and the next thing you're at the stove with, you know, a ground pork and mango and chili stir fry or something like that. It's just, you know, that's never happened, this that particular example, but like that's kind of how it works for me sometimes. There's tomorrow. A lot to be said for tomorrow, maybe tonight. There's a lot to be said for stream of consciousness when you're thinking about food. So anyway, you come up, or it could be straightforward, and somebody says, we need a recipe for a cheeseburger, and then you get to work on writing a recipe. Sometimes you're told what to do, and you don't need that much inspiration to begin with.
What makes a good cookbook?
You know, in my opinion, the funny thing about cookbooks is that, you know, there's all these doctors that say, my goal as a doctor is to put myself out of business. You know, you want to heal enough people to make sure that there's no sick people coming back to you. In a similar but much less noble way, I think the job of a recipe and the job of a cookbook is to teach people to cook so that they don't need to rely on those recipes and those books anymore. So maybe my job is to put myself out of business. I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I mean, and not all books are like that, are professing to teach people self-sufficiency in the kitchen. Some cookbooks have very complicated recipes that you're not going to get on the first or second or 20th try. And they're these, you know, things you keep coming back to over and over again. You know, my dad makes, it's my favorite thing in the world. He makes chicken marsala. He's been making it since I was a little kid. It's the greatest thing. It's the only recipe for chicken marsala I've ever had that doesn't include mushrooms, which I love. But anyway, you know, he's cooked it hundreds and hundreds of times, but I've never, ever seen him do it without the recipe. Like, this is his book. He comes back to it every time, and I think it sort of provides a lot of comfort for him in that way. But I think the goal of an individual recipe, at least this is what I keep in mind when I'm writing them, is to, you want to make people feel at ease in a recipe and in the kitchen. You know, if you're on edge while you're cooking, maybe your dish comes out great. Most likely it doesn't, but either way, you probably haven't had a tremendously good time cooking it. And I think, you know, if you want to cook regularly and want it to be something that you come back to and enjoy over and over again, it needs to be a process that you enjoy and not just a final product that you enjoy. So you want the process to be enjoyable and simple and have a good flow to it, and that's what a recipe should do. You know, there's a couple immediate turnoffs in a recipe to, you know, most people, or at least the average cook. You know, one is an incredibly long list of ingredients. If you don't need that many, don't put that many in. You know, another is huge blocks of prose. If you can break things up into shorter, little discrete sections, so much the better.
Wow, you just blew my mind a little bit. It is mid-September. The farmer's market is happening. You're there every Friday, mm-hmm. hanging out with Flying Pigs Farm. What are some of your favorite stands? And what are some of the things that you're buying right now that you recommend? And how would you use them in your kitchen right now?
So I'm never without pork in the freezer. So I do... You know, it's funny, for someone who works at a, this is like my Flying Pig side and my Mark Bittman side clashing. I work at a meat stand, but I don't eat a tremendous amount of meat. But what I love to do is just cruise by all of the different meat stands, pork, beef and chicken and duck, and, you know, buy whatever it is, a roast, ground, something like that, a whole duck, and cut everything up into like pretty small little portions. I plastic wrap the hell out of everything individually and keep it in the freezer, and then just pull out little pieces of meat here and there. And then I just supplement that with fresh vegetables. This was my first year actually in New York participating in a CSA. So I've gotten, I've been getting a weekly share from Norwich Meadows, which has been great. So they have sent over a ton of okra lately, which is a bit challenging for me because it's one of those ingredients that is not my favorite. The sliminess is like a little hard to get over for me. So I try to just cook the slime out. So there's been okra gumbo with little bits of, you know, crab stock lying around in the freezer. A lot of eggplant. They sent over little Japanese eggplants for a few weeks running, which I like much more than the bigger Italian kind. So I do those sort of Szechuan style with spicy garlic and chili sauce over a little bit of rice. I could eat that, I don't know, most days of the week. Tomatoes have been great. Fresh tomato sauce. This is one recipe that I will keep going back to over and over again from a cookbook is Marcella Hazan's tomato sauce. It's just, she uses canned tomatoes, but it's good with fresh too. That and a pretty decent hunk of butter and a big piece of onion, and you just kind of let it hang out and simmer. And we've been eating Sunday night pastas pretty regularly, which is good in my book.
We're going to take a really quick break, but when we get back, we have more from Daniel Meyer. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
Today's episode has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Free Market. Heritage breeds of pork, beef, antibiotic, hormone-free. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. And you're listening to Mis Amores by Jack Inslee, HRN Zone.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by Daniel Meyer. And before the break, we were discussing cooking and just everything, all food, everything, because we're on Heritage Radio Network. I just threw in a curveball. This week is the last week of pawpaw season. Most Americans don't know what pawpaws are. Pawpaws are one of the oldest American fruits. It's a tropical fruit. It kind of looks like a mango from the outside. And on the inside, it's got the craziest taste. So I just opened one up, and Daniel's about to try it for the first time. I want you to taste it and tell me what you think.
I'm too busy smelling it. It's got this really weird smell that doesn't quite smell like food. It's like a little...
It smells yeasty, right? It's weird.
It does. That's exactly right. I was going to say pasty, but you're right. It smells like yeast.
It's really weird looking. You have to use a spoon. It's really custard-like, and it's got these giant, giant seeds that you're not supposed to eat. But this was Thomas Jefferson's favorite fruit. He had a whole orchard of it at Monticello. Lewis and Clark, apparently, when they were starving, would find this in the forest. What do you think?
It's amazing. It's like it's already turned itself into pudding.
Mm-hmm.
It's so soft. It's super creamy.
Instant pudding. It kind of tastes like a cross between a mango and a banana.
And it's got that texture like a rice pudding.
Why? Like, this is basically the best fruit I've ever had.
Is it your favorite fruit?
I think so. And no one has cultivated it. You can typically only find it in the wild. There's only two farms in the U.S. that grow it.
In what states?
One guy is in Maryland. The other is in Ohio. But who knows? Maybe that'll change. It's pretty dope. So what would you do with this? Because, like, you know, it's a custard, basically.
I couldn't imagine cooking with this. Not because you couldn't. I'm sure mm-hmm. you could do a number of things with it. But because it's, like, so, you know... In the same way that I wouldn't really do too much to uni or something, or, you know, scallop roe or something like that, something that's really soft and incredibly flavorful to start out with. I feel like this has a pretty delicate flavor. I feel like if you started heating it up too much, it might lose it a little bit.
I think it's just waiting for a Paco jet and beautiful sorbet. I don't know, but I'm really simple. So, you know, I'm going to let you eat a little pawpaw for the moment, but...
You know what I would do? I would, in the height of... Do these grow in the summer? Can you get them in the summer?
So, technically, their growing season happens from August to October, but given the climate change, it matured too quickly this year, so the season has actually ended. A couple people are, you know, able to get it for the next 2 weeks or so, but... Honestly, it's pretty hard to come by.
I would throw it in the freezer for a little bit and cool it down, and it would turn itself into its own little ice cream. It's so creamy. It's got that texture of... It's more than sorbet. It's got that texture of ice cream.
Isn't it weird?
You ever put frozen sliced bananas in the food processor?
No.
They turn into ice cream. What? Miraculously, they take on the texture of ice cream. They get super creamy. They blend together. A little bit tacky, sort of sticks to the roof of your mouth a little bit, but a great approximation of ice cream. So this kind of has that same thing going for it.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, this looks like someone worked really hard to make a dessert, but actually it's just instant pudding.
Then I would write a recipe for pawpaw custard for a simple dinner party or something where you just cut it in half and pretend that you worked for hours making it, impress your friends.
I think the directions would involve, like, open a beer, cut it open, there you go. That's, you know.
I'm a big fan of recipes where you can do other things while you're cooking.
While you're hanging out.
If you can drink beer while cooking, so much the better. If you can take a shower while you're cooking, even better.
Well, speaking of drinking, so big news broke this afternoon in New York City. Big gulps, no mas for a while.
The interesting thing, it's funny that you mentioned big gulps because of all the things that are actually going to be prohibited by, you're talking about the soda ban. I presume, of all the things that are going to be sort of prohibited in some way, big gulps, actually, the most egregious offender aren't one of them. Because the only places that are regulated under this ban are sort of locations that are regulated by the health department, the ones that are given those nice letter grades, mostly A's, sometimes, you know, B's and C's. But convenience stores like 7-Eleven aren't actually included under the law. So you can still...
Oh, thank God.
You know, you can't get a 20-ounce soda at McDonald's, but you can feel safe that you can get a 64-ounce double big gulp at 7-Eleven.
Man, I mean, because I was wondering, I was like, so this basically means that movies will no longer be interrupted by people in the audience because they can't get up continually because they've been drinking the, like, XXL cup of Coke.
True, but the problem is that they're going to have to keep getting up to refill their sodas because they won't have had enough. They won't have had enough the first time. But yes, I mean, one of the, you know, one of the main things that critics of this policy have said is that, you know, it's not, it's an unnecessary ban because it's not actually, it's not actually addressing the problem because people can still access the same things that they've always been able to access. That's actually something that proponents of the ban have said too, that it's not actually a, you know, you're not really inhibiting people's ability to drink as much soda as they want. You're just making it, you know, difficult, more, a little more difficult in certain settings. You're going to have to go back up to the counter and get a second, you know,
they're making you 60. Think about it. Yeah.
Right. They're making you think about it. I mean, and it's pretty clear that, if presented with a certain quantity of something, in this case, something that's particularly bad for your health, that we'll consume it. So, you know, I think that the promise of this, I think it's unfortunate in a way that it had to, you know, go through slightly sneaky channels. This wasn't put to a vote. I think most New Yorkers actually opposed it, but this was sort of jammed through by Bloomberg and the health department, which is commendable ultimately, I think. It's a shame that it couldn't be passed by consensus, but you know, I think that the real promise of this is not necessarily in seeing huge drops in obesity right now. You know, if you are a grown-up and you are intent on drinking 64 ounces of soda in a sitting, this is not going to stop you. But, you know, 10 and 20 and 30 and 50 years down the road, I think that there we'll come to see a time where drinking that much soda in one sitting is not normal. Now it's, you know, now it's become a normal thing. It wasn't that way 50 years ago. I don't think it's going to be that way 50 years from now. And I think this is the kind of policy that's, you know, starting us down that road, even if just a little bit.
It is election season. And something else interesting that's going on is Prop 37 in California. Can you explain what it is?
Sure. So Proposition 37 is a ballot initiative that's coming up on the ballot in November. In California, which, if passed, would require that, you know, any products containing ingredients that are the result of genetic modification be labeled, which, you know, as far as I can tell, it's one of the biggest, you know, it's one of the biggest things on the food policy front that's come around in a while. It's a pretty important vote. I think it's going to pass. I think currently in California, maybe about two thirds of voters are for it, and maybe something like 20-something% against it. You know, it would be and nationally, I think it's something like 91% of people would like the FDA to require labeling of genetically modified ingredients in the stuff that we buy. So there's a good amount of consensus. You know, it's really kind of like the soda ban. It's not a prohibition. You know, this isn't stopping companies from pursuing GMO technology. It's not stopping anybody from putting those genetically modified ingredients in processed foods or anything else. But it is giving consumers sort of the power to know what's in their food, and they can make decisions from there. But I think if it passes, which I think it will, it'll have long lasting effects that sort of go pretty far down the line.
What other policies? I mean, there's the farm bill, and actually Stanford recently came out with a study on organics. Take a stab at one of those.
So I'll take the organics one, because actually somebody last weekend, I was at a dinner up in the Hudson Valley in New York for a sustainable agriculture institute, and I told somebody that I, you know, did some work with the New York Times, and they became very angry, and they were sort of they were questioning, that's to putting it mildly, sort of the coverage of the study and the study itself, which basically was a group of researchers from Stanford came out with a study which wasn't new. It wasn't new data. I don't think it was just they were aggregating data from hundreds of older studies, and they came to the conclusion that organic foods aren't better in terms of nutritional quality and value than conventional foods. So if you eat an organic apple, you're not getting sort of a nutrient boost as opposed to eating one that's grown conventionally. I think in the past few days, it's come out that that the institute that funded that research has, you know, significant, maybe, I don't know, somewhere in the millions of dollars, I don't know if that's significant for them, ties with Cargill, which is a big multinational agribusiness corporation. I think that part is beside the point. I think the study just missed the point a little bit. I don't know many people who go out to the farmer's market or the supermarket and seek out organic products because they're more nutritious necessarily than conventional products. The reasons that people are into organic agriculture and organic products is that you know, the produce it doesn't have as many pesticides on it. The meat has much lower incidence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. You know, organic agriculture generally means better stewardship of the land and the environment. You know, the things that, you know, the true health of organics, I think, has a lot less to do with, you know, vitamin A and vitamin C than it does with kind of a larger vision for the food system and the things that are important to consumers. So I think I didn't put a lot of stock in the study because I think they just, whether they're funded by, you know, big agribusiness or not, I think they just didn't take on the point as straightly as they could.
We have to wrap things up, but Daniel Meyer, what's on the horizon for you? We can look forward to seeing from you.
Well, hopefully many more recipes. I'm starting to do some more sort of freelance recipe development and testing for a startup, which I won't mention now because it hasn't launched yet, and who knows, it could be out of business by the time I take my headset off, so you never know. I've started doing some writing for Serious Eats, the blog, on sort of profiles on interesting people in the New York food world in one way or the other. So hopefully I can continue with those. And yeah, you can come out and see me every Friday at the farmer's market at Flying Pigs Farm if you ever want pork, and hopefully just keep going.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the delicious papa.
Next year, I'll get you a lot more.
Fantastic.
Than just one. And thanks to Joe Galarraga, Jack Inslee, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.